Welcome once again to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with our political gurus, Steve Missler and Mal Leary. Maine's second congressional district was one the Democrats flipped in last year's congressional election. Jared Golden narrowly defeated incumbent Republican Bruce Poliquin. Another close race is possible this year. Mal, let's start by talking a little bit about the makeup of this district, which reaches all the way from Lewiston to Fort Kent.
Well, Erwin, it's a much more conservative district than the first congressional district. There's a lot of rural towns. There's a lot of rural areas. We do have a couple of cities, Lewiston, Bangor. But the reality is, when you look at the overall demographics, it's much more conservative. And that was borne out in the 2016 race when Donald Trump, for the first time, was able to use that provision in Maine law that splits our electoral votes. And he won the second district while losing the state. That goes to show you the difference, because down in the first district, the support for Hillary Clinton was so strong that it overcame the 10-point win that Trump had in the second district.
Interesting, but Jared Golden still managed to win. So that district did go Democratic in 2018.
The situation was a little bit different, if you recall. We actually had ranked choice voting. In this case, you got to remember there were two independents on the ballot, as well as the Republican and Democratic nominees. Now, in the first vote, when you looked at just who won the plurality, that was the incumbent, Bruce Poliquin, won by a small margin. It was only after you applied ranked choice voting and folks' second choice within the independents went strongly to Jared Golden that he then won the seat. You know, you go back to the past, folks would be able to win a plurality, win a seat in Congress with 45% of the vote, let's say. Mm-hmm. And because the independents would take some votes, but that's it. They were not then reassigned as we see under ranked choice voting.
All right, Steve Missler, so far incumbent Golden has no Democratic primary opponent, but who is lining up on the Republican side to challenge him?
Well, at the moment, there are three Republican candidates in the mix. Each, I would say, represent different factions of the state party. So let's start with the person who first got into the race. That was Eric Brakey, a former state senator from Auburn who left the legislature last year to take on Senator Angus King in the U.S. Senate race. That didn't go so well for Brakey, who lost by nearly 20 points. But he does have some remnants of the old libertarian sort of Ron Paul movement behind him, which helps explain, I think, some of the money he's been able to raise so far. Now, the problem he faces is he's had some difficulty getting the entire party behind him, or conservative voters writ large. This was the case last year when he initially drew a primary challenger because he was perceived as being lukewarm on Donald Trump. Now, Brakey is going full Trump, going so far as to embrace the president's decision to abandon Kurdish allies in Syria, a move that's drawn fierce and bipartisan opposition in Congress. Then you have Adrian Bennett, a former television reporter and longtime spokesman to Governor Paul LePage. Bennett got in the race this week and is highlighting her background as a working mother who grew up poor, and of course her work for LePage, who apparently remains a popular figure among conservative voters because current and aspiring politicians here keep invoking his name. The problem for Bennett is that another GOP candidate, the other one who got into the race just Thursday, Dale Crafts of Lisbon, is claiming that LePage has already endorsed him. But let's set aside LePage's preference for a moment and just talk about Crafts. He's a businessman, a deeply religious conservative, and a former member of the Maine House of Representatives. He obviously has some political experience because of his previous service, but I'd argue his candidacy benefits from having a formidable organization. And that's because he's backed by former state senator Garrett Mason, whose campaign for governor last year was very disciplined and very effective, I'd say, because it also seemed to sync up with religious conservative voters who historically have punched above their weight in terms of showing up and voting. Now, Mason came in second in the GOP gubernatorial primary, but I think he and his organization could really help Crafts, despite the fact that Crafts may not be that well known to many Maine voters.
Interesting. Do we know, Steve Missler, who former Governor LePage would back in this race or is backing in this race?
Well, Kraft says he's got the governor's endorsement. But Adrian Bennett, in various interviews she did earlier this week, has sort of hinted that it's possible that he would endorse her. And the governor has not responded to requests for comments. So it's not quite clear if he's endorsed either or one of them.
Well, what's also crucial here is where does Bruce Poliquin come down? He decided not to seek this time, and that's why we have this three-way primary. When he comes out and endorses someone, it may not have quite the weight of Paula Page, but it will have significant weight in the second district.
Sometimes we put a lot of emphasis on the endorsements, right? And you know, obviously, is it good for a Republican candidate that a person of LePage's stature is backing them? Sure. But I also think the endorsement has its limits, especially when you're talking about a person like LePage or even Trump, because first off, it isn't necessarily helpful when a GOP candidate gets to the general election. Just ask Sean Moody and Eric Brakey, who both had LePage's backing last year and both lost in convincing fashion. And that's because LePage and Trump are like very deeply polarizing figures, right? It's certainly more helpful in the primary, but again, I think there are limits because the support of LePage and Trump arguably comes from more from their charisma and personality than it does any particular value system that could help voters draw a direct link between the candidate and the person making the endorsement.
How does the makeup of this district complicate things for Golden? He is a Democrat, but he'll be facing issues concerning, for instance, the impeachment inquiry, gun control, stuff like that.
Well, at the moment, I think the biggest challenge for Golden is navigating impeachment. Yeah, he had a D rating from the NRA, but I tend to think he's relatively inoculated from that group's attacks because he's a combat veteran, and that makes it pretty difficult to portray him as soft on guns, especially when he hasn't taken any votes on gun control that could be used against him. The impeachment inquiry is another matter because the district, as Mal pointed out, went so hard for Trump in 2016. So he has to be careful about going all in on the impeachment inquiry when that could really tick off a lot of his constituents. At the same time, he might find safe harbor in what appears to be a shift in public opinion on impeachment, since some national polling shows growing support for the inquiry. And I have to wonder if the president's decision on Syria will fuel support, even though the issue is completely separate from the impeachment inquiry, which is focused on whether the president abused his office by seeking Ukraine's government's help to investigate his political rival, Joe Biden. And you could also make the case that Golden's carefully articulated positions on impeachment and gun control actually hurt him more with the liberal activists who helped him get elected last year. At the moment, I think that poses perhaps a bigger threat to his reelection bid, is if he can't get those people to help him get out votes next year, that could be potentially more damaging than whatever he happens to say about President Trump.
It's really a question of enthusiasm when we talk about the Democrats. It's not that they're going to get behind anybody else. It's either they won't work for them or they won't turn out. Either way, that's a problem.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's less about the voters there. If you're a Democratic voter, you're going to vote for Golden. It's just if you don't have activists pushing people out to get you out to the polls, that's the jeopardy he potentially faces.
And I think we have to put a fine point on what's going on in terms of public opinion on impeachment. What was most interesting to me was that all of the polls that have come out show the group that is shifting are independents.
Yeah, that's right.
Democrats overwhelmingly support impeachment. Republicans overwhelmingly oppose impeachment. It is the independents that have moved. And as we know, the independents don't tend to vote in the same numbers as party members. But if they do, particularly in our state, they will control the election.
But we don't have yet any state-specific polling about Maine and what Mainers are thinking about this impeachment, correct?
No, we don't. That'll be interesting to see, and that could be revelatory when it actually comes.
Mal, Democrat Mike Michaud did hold this seat for years. What was his secret?
He was a blue dog conservative Democrat. Not much of a secret about that at all. He was more conservative than most fellow Democrats. And I think that was the secret to his success. That, and he probably had one of the best constituent services organizations that you can have. And that's a big factor that gets overlooked in a lot of elections. When you're an incumbent, you've got that built-in advantage that you helped Aunt Mary and Uncle George get their Social Security fixed when it was screwed up by the administration. That is a big factor that goes to people supporting, hey, it was Congressman Michaud's office that straightened out that problem for me or straightened it out for one of my relatives. And I think his conservative bent certainly was enough to attract that shifting group in the second district that are more conservative than folks in the first district, but they're really not all the way to the right.
And to Mao's point about how Michaud was so effective as an incumbent, I mean, he survived one of the biggest wave elections in 2010 when Republicans just, you know, swept throughout the country and Maine. They took over entire state government in Maine. Michaud cruised to re-election in that, and he had a pretty good challenger. You know, he really demonstrated the power of incumbency. It's harder to do that when you're a freshman like Golden because you haven't been there that long. Once you get past this first hurdle, you can start to accumulate that power that Michaud had throughout his various terms.
All right. We started this conversation by talking about the makeup of the 2nd Congressional District. Now, after next year's election, the legislature will have to redraw the boundary lines based on the findings of the 2020 census. What happened the last time the legislature did this? And what may be the political calculations that go into redrawing the district next time?
It really depends, I think, Irwin, on the makeup of the legislature. The Democrats stay in control. I don't think you're going to see much change. You're going to see some shifting of towns because the reality is the 2nd district is losing population while the 1st district has been slightly gaining population. So to reach that magic threshold to divide the district so they're equal in population is going to be difficult. More importantly is this may be the last time that Maine has two members of the House of Representatives. We're stagnant, if not slightly losing population, and we may well slip into the status of Wyoming or Montana, where we have just one at-large representative come the 2030 census.
But tell us a little bit about the last time that we did do this. There was some talk about redrawing the boundary to make it a more north-south split.
There's been that discussion over the three redistrictings that I've covered, and the reality is they throw out all kinds of ideas. What's more interesting is the fact you're also going to see the redistricting of the legislature, where you really get into some interesting battles because, quite frankly, the political figures in the House and Senate are out to protect themselves. And the congressional districts really are so closely balanced, they don't have to move many towns to make it work. My favorite one was, I think it was the last time around, we had the Republicans propose a congressional district that we called the Donut in Biddeford, where literally you took all of the little communities around the periphery of Biddeford that were more conservative than the areas inside the city, and the Republicans wanted to do that because they had to then have a shot at electing a representative from that district. I suspect there's going to be more emphasis and energy placed on legislative reapportionment than we will see on the congressional side.
And Mal has touched on something we've seen, at least we saw last year in the last legislative election, which is that for years, I'd say the last, 10 or 15, Republicans have been really focused on winning state legislatures because of this very issue. They understood and strategized around winning state houses because legislatures, they are in charge of apportionment. And each state is a little bit different. But, you know, in Maine, the legislative leaders pick the bipartisan committee that draws the map. Obviously, the party in control is the legislative leader. So what you saw last year was Democrats for the first time sort of trying to catch up with Republicans and putting emphasis on winning state houses because of the census that's coming up in 2020. Because after that, then the legislatures go, they redraw maps. You know, if you have the majority, your party has a better chance of drawing a map that you want. Whereas before, Democrats, I think, were so focused on the presidency or whatever that they didn't really make that a focus. Republicans did. And that's why you saw in other states, not so much Maine, in other states, you saw these crazy maps, really gerrymandered, you know, helped ensure longtime Republican majorities in both the state houses and their congressional districts. That's why Democrats have said, wow, we better catch up to this game and really focus on that. In fact, there's like PACs that have been formed with that specific intent on legislative redistricting.
For those people who may have good long memories, the last time the Maine legislature redistricted was, I believe, now 2013, but we have since amended the state constitution, so the next time it happens will actually be in 2021, correct?
That's correct. You have a little bit of delay obviously, because you have to get all of that census data. And you got to remember, this redistricting gets down not just to city, not just to cities and towns or counties, but it gets down to census tracts. Mm-hmm. A group of houses bounded by a couple of streets is one of the building blocks for these districts.
Yeah, some of these districts are crazy. They look like snakes, or, you know, just the way they move around different neighborhoods, or, you know, in some cases dividing a neighborhood, you know, depending on a concentration of voters that may be perceived as being conservative or liberal.
That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. You can download new versions of The Pulse each Friday afternoon at 3. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz.